Hey there, and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman.
And I'm Paris Schutz. Here's what we're looking at. The city of Nashville is in mourning following the deaths of six people, including three children, in a mass shooting at an elementary school.
It is lead paint that is poisoning children in Chicago today.
It's a toxic hazard in many Chicago homes. What's been done to address the city's lead paint problem?
A government mole testifies in the bribery trial of the so-called ComEd 4.
A CTA staffing shortfall and better bike safety. What transit advocates want to see from their next mayor.
And towering alebrijes are on the move from a local park to a suburban mall. Find out where you can see them. And now to our top story tonight. Getting the lead out of Chicago homes. It's a costly proposition, but perhaps life-saving for children. Last Monday, we reported on Chicago's widespread lead-based paint problem, a toxic hazard still present in the vast majority of city apartments. That's despite the city's 1978 ban on lead-based paint. Last week, we introduced you to a young child who was poisoned in his Belmont Cragen apartment and now faces a host of health problems. It spurred a debate on whether the city can do more to fix the problem before another child is affected.
I didn't know where this was coming from. Where was he poisoned? And then we found out he was poisoned in our own home.
Elena Long says she worries whether her 2-year-old son, Jedi, will ever be able to live a normal life. We recently brought you Jedi's story. He was rushed to the emergency room in October after doctors discovered a blood lead level of 76 micrograms. That's 14 times the threshold considered dangerous. Chicago health inspectors found a rash of lead paint hazards in their former apartment in Belmont Cragen, peeling chips on doorways, windowsills, and lead dust on floors.
It is lead paint that is poisoning children in Chicago today.
Chicago Department of Public Health Director Dr. Allison Arwadi says lead paint hazards are present in 99% of Chicago homes built before 1978. That represents the vast majority of the city's housing stock.
Oftentimes, there are hazards in your home. This refuge that we go back to again and again and again, where we spend so much of our life, is oftentimes unhealthy and not safe.
John Bartlett is CEO of the Metropolitan Tenants Organization. He says the city's health department is only equipped to step in once a positive blood lead level has been reported.
No one should be being lead poisoned any longer because of this. We need to put more investment in it, and we need to be more proactive about dealing with the problem.
According to CDPH data, Chicago has made progress. In 2021, fewer than 2% of children tested positive for elevated lead levels in their blood. That's down from 70% 25 years earlier. But CDPH says fewer than half of Chicago children are regularly tested, and many low-income neighborhoods are reporting as many as 40% of residents with positive test results. Dr. Anita Raghavan is a pediatrician at U of C Comer Children's Hospital, the facility that treated Jedi. She says lead poisoning in children is linked to behavioral and irreversible cognitive health issues.
Increased lead levels can affect a child's developing brain, specifically cognitive delays and learning disabilities. There's lower IQ scores that have been attributed to, for example, from a lead level of less than 1 to a lead level of 10. Studies have shown a drop in an IQ of 6.2 points, which is significant.
After Jedi's emergency room visit, he was diagnosed with mixed expressive language disorder, autism spectrum disorder, and moderate cognitive impairment.
It is our responsibility as government to take care of people.
33rd Ward Alderwoman Rosana Rodriguez Sanchez says she wants the city to tackle the problem before more kids get poisoned. She's sponsoring an ordinance that would create a pilot program in a handful of wards where health inspectors would screen housing units for lead paint and other health hazards every 5 years.
It is a public safety crisis. When you rent a property and bring your family in, you want to know that that is a safe space for your family. I think that this is something that can be done in phases, and I do believe that we have the resources to do it.
Dr. Arwadi says a proactive citywide program would require an astronomical 600 new health inspectors. She says the city should instead focus on the highest risk units.
Where we know there are problem buildings from the buildings department, where we know that there are homes with, that have the potential for higher level of lead. You know, there's agreement about that we could be doing more on this.
Elena Long says she hopes Jedi's story provides a wake-up call to the city.
I don't know how renters are still, providing these apartments to people, and in these conditions, our children are getting sick.
And we reached out to a representative from the Chicagoland Apartment Association multiple times for this story, but did not hear back. The proposed ordinance called the Healthy Homes Checkup Pilot Program is currently sitting in City Council's Committee on Housing and Real Estate. Elena Long says her son is still recording blood lead levels at about 3 times the level considered hazardous. This is 5 months after he was first poisoned.
Wow, that is significant, Paris. Is there any kind of legal or financial recourse for tenants who get lead poisoning from paint?
From talking to advocates and this family, it's a tricky situation, and there really isn't much. And that's because a lot of landlords carry insurance that has a lead paint exemption in it, so you can't really sue for many damages if their insurance isn't covering it. So a lot of lawyers don't take these cases, so renters don't have a whole lot of recourse. As in terms of like financial assistance, there is federal assistance for landlords, not the renters, but landlords who have lead problems. There's financial money for them to get it abated, but this process takes months. This apartment still has not had its problem abated yet.
Oh, wow. Good reporting, Paris. Thank you.
Thanks.
And now to some of our top stories. 6 people are reported dead after a shooting at a Nashville school this morning. The dead include 3 children and 3 adults after a 28-year-old woman reportedly opened fire at Nashville's Covenant School. Police say the shooter attended the Nashville Elementary School at one point and is reported to have been shot and killed by police in a standoff. Police say the investigation is ongoing.
The family of a disabled woman killed in a bus crash in 2021 will receive a $13 million legal settlement.
Pace Bus Service and its subcontractor, SCR Medical Transportation, violated the public trust. They did so by putting a driver on the road that was known to be a danger, and they shifted that danger onto the public.
Attorneys for the family of Brenda Burst say the driver of the medical transport bus that crashed in August 2021 was known to have sleep apnea. That's a disorder that they say should have disqualified him from the job. They say he fell asleep behind the wheel, causing the crash that killed Burst, and they obtained video of other instances where he fell asleep on the job. The case was scheduled to go to trial last week, but the company settled with Burst's family on the first day of that trial. The driver may still face criminal charges in Cook County.
With ComEd in the news, the city's other big utility is facing some heat as well. Consumer advocate and environmental groups got together to protest proposed people's gas rate hikes. They say the natural gas utility is seeking a $400 million increase in rates that would add $140 per year to the average taxpayer, average ratepayer's bill. They're calling on the Illinois Commerce Commission, that's the unelected body that regulates utility rates, to turn the proposal down.
And while People's Gas rakes in record profits, we're left with soaring utility bills, and our city has been plunged into a heating affordability crisis.
Neighbors in East Garfield Park will get some more neighbors after a new 7-story, 63-unit apartment building is built. The city announces the new $47 million equitable transit-oriented development is the winning proposal to develop the vacant city land next to the CTA Green Line. The new building will be called Hub 32 and will feature all affordable housing units, as well as retail space, a public plaza, and a restaurant. The half-acre site at the southwest corner of Lake Street and Kedzie has been empty since the early 70s. Construction could start early next year.
And coming up in the program, a wish list of changes to transit for Chicago's next mayor.
But first, prosecutors bring in their star witness in the so-called ComEd 4 trial, Amanda Vinicky, with the details right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by Alexandra and John Nichols, the Jim and Kay Mabee family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
And An alleged bribery plot was all about making and keeping former Illinois House Speaker Michael Madigan happy. That's the gist of a testimony from a key government witness in the so-called ComEd 4 case. And Amanda Vinicky joins us now. Amanda, you were at the courtroom today watching the proceedings. What stood out?
Well, Paris, this was day 8 of the trial, and it was a significant one, prominently featuring Fidel Marquez, formerly a top executive with ComEd who was in charge of government relations. As such, he was in a key position to serve as a mole for the FBI. It's a role he agreed to play after the FBI had come knocking on his own door in early 2019. Marquez admitted to bribery in exchange for his cooperation since, including his testimony today. He may serve no prison time. Whether four of his former colleagues, each of whom have pleaded not guilty, will do so depends in part on how a jury views what he had to say.
And what did Marquez have to say on the stand?
Well, Marquez shared that ComEd didn't have a great relationship with former Illinois House Speaker Michael Madigan. He says that Madigan had grown not to trust ComEd because of some mistruths regarding negotiations on failed legislation in the early 2000s. But he laid out for the jury how ComEd execs, including former CEO Ann Premajor, focused on turning that around with the help of a key confidant of Madigan's, lobbyist Michael McLean. Marquez says McLean was known as a double agent because while the lobbyist was loyal to ComEd, it was known within ComEd circles that McLean was even more loyal to Madigan, which is why Marquez says when he got a request from McLean, he knew he had to act on it with urgency. Marquez says he knew that directions from McLean were really coming from higher up, from Madigan.
And what sort of requests were some of these?
Well, Marquez says that early into getting that top government relations job that he held with ComEd, he was given a to-do list, and on it was hiring a relative of then-state representative Monique Davis. Marquez went on to detail other such requests, like fixing lobbying contracts for Madigan allies, including those who Marquez says didn't have the skills for those jobs. He says those subcontractors, that is, didn't do any work despite getting paid what amounts to a middle-class salary from ComEd. Even as the exec at ComEd in charge of managing lobbying contracts, he says he hadn't even initially known about some of these subcontractors whose payments were hidden under that of more prominent lobbyist contracts. Even today, Marquez says he wouldn't have been able to point one of them out, Madigan precinct captain Ray Nice, if Nice had been in the courtroom. But Marquez says he did all of this with the full consent of Premajor, who he says had become friendly with Madigan and who wanted everything possible done to make sure that Madigan had a favorable disposition towards ComEd, because she knew, Marquez testified, that Madigan was a linchpin in the killing or advancing of legislation, including bills that, as played for the jury on a wiretapped call, Premajor credited with advancing her to CEO of ComEd's then parent company, Exelon.
And Amanda, what are some of the other big takeaways from the testimony today?
Well, Paris, this was the first time that the jury heard Premajor on a call with ComEd. And also they saw and heard, therefore, but then also saw in email exhibits what the prosecution is hoping serves as proof to jurors that Premajor and the other defendants were involved in details of the bribery scheme. Details including like what subcontracts should be paid under and how much. Marquez also says he hired on another lobbyist, that's former state representative Eddie Acevedo, despite reservations, because that was seen as important to Madigan in keeping Latino politicians happy. Now, we did not hear much from the defense today, Paris. This was only really, we got a bunch of objections, most of which were overruled. But when it is their turn to cross-examine, look for them to try to poke holes and say that, yes, Madigan was powerful, but it is regular lobbying work to try to make him happy, of course, as the prominent speaker of the House and head of the party. Again, this was the third week of this trial. Marquez expected to again take the stand tomorrow, but we are expecting to have many more weeks ahead, up to 8.
Many more weeks, a lot of moving parts, a lot of people for these jurors to keep track of, and that has been the defense strategy so far. Hey, it's just lobbying, as opposed to the prosecution strategy that, no, it crossed that line. And that's where all this is coming down to. Amanda, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And up next, what transit advocates want to see from Chicago's next mayor. So please stay with us.
buses that never show up and unreliable train travel times, filling a CTA staffing shortfall, and a push for better bike safety. Those are just a few of the transit topics on the minds of voters as they head to the ballot box for the mayoral runoff election next week. Joining us to talk about what transit ideas they hope to see from the next mayor are P.S. Sriraj, director of the Urban Transportation Center at the University of Illinois Chicago, Audrey Winnink, senior director for transportation at the Metropolitan Planning Council, and Jose Manuel Almanza Jr., director of advocacy and movement building for Equiticity. Thanks to the three of you for joining us. Jose Almanza, let's start with you, please. Does this sort of uncertainty that we keep hearing from transit riders about arrivals, you know, buses and trains always being late, does that also play into public safety?
Absolutely. You know, if people know exactly what time the bus or train is going to arrive and what time exactly they're going to get to their destination, people can plan accordingly. You know, a lot less things can happen if you're only waiting for a bus or a train for a minute or two because you know exactly when it's going to get there than if you don't know when it's going to get there and you're waiting for up to an hour. And that is unacceptable here in Chicago.
Jose, the Lightfoot administration, they've attempted to make transit safer by increasing the amount of security guards. Is that enough? Is that something that the next mayor should continue?
No, that's not enough. We need to reshape the conversation and talk about safety from a new lens, a different lens. You know, people will feel safer if there is a full ridership. If there's more people around, people will feel safer. Additionally, the CTA should hire conductors and ambassadors so that they can de-escalate and deal with a lot of the situations that are happening on the train and the bus, and that'll make people feel safer as well.
We've reported on how CTA continues to rely on overtime as the agency has lost bus drivers. Sriraj, how can the next mayor better support CTA workers and recruit more people to join the ranks?
It is a tough call. Mainly because there is such an acute shortage of operators in the CTA, not just in the CTA, but all across the transit industry. There's been severe competition from other sectors that are better paying, less strenuous, and less stressful, that people have been gravitating to. Not to mention there's been a sea change in how operators have looked at these episodes going through the pandemic and coming out of it. There's been a lot of pressure on them, because many of them had pre-existing conditions that would have made them susceptible to catching COVID or any other virus. So there's been a renewed look at how they want to run their lives and shape their careers. And so it's going to be a very, very onerous task for any new coming mayor or a president of CTA to bring back the workforce. So there has to be a very different lens to looking at how to entice the workforce to return back to the fold. And it's got to be a collective effort.
Audrey, something many CTA riders complain about are ghost buses and trains, where the tracker says that a bus or a train is coming in 3 minutes. 3 minutes comes and go, no bus, no train. What are key steps that the next administration can take to improve transit reliability?
Yeah, I mean, they definitely need to work on the software to make sure that they don't have buses that appear to be scheduled that aren't coming, so that people are not frustrated and don't lose confidence. I would agree with the staffing. The staffing is really going to be key in terms of making sure that they can staff all the buses that are on the schedule so they don't show up on the schedule and then not be running.
Sriraj, how can the new mayor help improve CTA ridership as well, getting more people to use CTA?
That's the billion-dollar question. There's been so many other impacts that affect the ridership. The work-from-home phenomenon is here to stay, whether we like it or not. How do people transition to a work week on a consistent basis is going to be reflecting on what the transit ridership is going to look like. Like Metro has gone to a regional rail model, which is a way of saying we are no longer a commuter rail, but we are going to serve all trips. That may be what all transit agencies ought to be doing in terms of why depend on the peak commute as the basis for your existence, but when you can serve many other trip types, when the work trips are eroding and you're giving way to the telecommute or work from home phenomenon, how do you balance it out with other trip types that are leisure or other shopping trips or other trip types? How do you bring them back into the fold is going to be the challenge for transit operators and managers.
And of course, CTA, public transit, is not the only consideration for the next mayor. From 2020 to July 2022, at least 439 cyclists have been hit by drivers in bike lanes. This is according to Block Club Chicago and the Illinois Answers Project. Audrey, what ideas are you looking for in the mayor's next plan to address bike safety?
Yeah, we want to see more protected bike lanes and a real network of protected bike lanes so people can go to various points throughout the city and have the entire route be protected, and continued efforts to make sure we're not seeing cars blocking bike lanes. One really good thing that just happened was passing the Safe Streets Ordinance, which is going to pilot enforcing bike lanes in the downtown. So implementation of that pilot will be happening during the next administration.
And I want to come back to that pilot in just a second as well. But Jose, what do you think the next mayor should do to improve the bike grid?
Yeah, those are all great ideas. Something to add on is having dedicated bus lanes. And that'll do well to reduce the stress that bus operators face every day, battling traffic, battling to get out of a bus stop and into a lane. And then that also decreased the ride, the time it takes to get from point A to point B, increasing ridership.
Chicago City Council, as you just mentioned, Audrey, recently approved that pilot program where owners of parked cars in bike and bus lanes downtown will get a ticket if a city camera snaps that infraction. Shriraj, should the next mayor make this pilot program permanent?
It really depends on how the results are showing up. We've had some experiences with the speed and red light enforcement cameras in the past in Chicago. So let the numbers speak about how effective they've been in addressing the problem. And based on that, a recommendation can be made. So at this point, it'll be very premature to talk about scaling it up without knowing how effective those cameras have been in enforcing the issue that you're trying to enforce.
Audrey, what specifics are you looking for in a candidate's transit plan when it comes to equitable transit-oriented development?
Yeah, we have the Connected Communities Ordinance that was passed last year, which is incentivizing development around transit. And the mayor's office has actually implemented funding for pilot projects along near transit stations, and we'd like to see more of that to come. So you're supporting emerging businesses as they're trying to develop locations near transit.
Jose, we're almost out of time, but, you know, what is one transit topic that you have not heard candidates talk about enough that you'd like to hear more of?
That's a great question. One thing is expanding and reopening the Green Line Racine stop. I can't tell you how many times I've heard community members just wanting that Racine stop to be reopened again. It'll be great for the community. It'll be great to increase ridership. And not too many people are talking about the Racine Green Line.
Okay, that's where we'll have to leave it. My thanks to the three of you, Jose Manuel Almanza Jr., Audrey Winnick, and P.S. Suraj. Thank you, all three of you. Up next, Mexican folk art comes to life. We'll show you where right after a look at the weather.
At that 66 on Friday. If you weren't able to make it out to Cantini Park last summer to see the Creatures of a Dream World exhibition of Alebrijes, you have some good news. 20 of those supersized sculptures have traveled to North Riverside Park Mall, where you can see them before they move on once more.
Alebrijes are spread throughout the mall. They're on both the upper level and the lower level. Some are finished, some are in the process of being restored. They were outside at Cantini for 6 months. So the elements of nature took their toll. They were stored over the winter at the DuPage County Fairgrounds, so they got even more snow that way. And then they are going to permanent installations. So we partnered with the Mexican Cultural Center of DuPage and brought in 20 pieces here, brought the artists back here to be able to allow people to see the restoration process. And it's been amazing. So the artists have come from Mexico, which is the greatest thing. So we get to kind of host the artists for a month at a time. A lot of people stop and they talk and they ask about the process and they ask about what he's doing. There are 12 million artists in Mexico who are doing this kind of art and who are unseen, unsung kind of heroes. To be able to host three of them here is a great thing. To actually see the papier-mâché, So at Cantini, they were amazing and vibrant and beautiful. When you see them coming together, it's kind of a different appreciation of the actual paper and paste. That education for people and just the awareness of a whole different kind of art is fascinating.
What a fun thing to see at the mall. Three Cartonoria artists will be in residence through April 19th, and the exhibition will be at North Riverside Park Mall through May 7th.
And that's our show for this Monday night. Please join us tomorrow night live at 10. The latest on the fate of a suburban bakery targeted for planning a drag performance.
And what's at stake for public schools as the city chooses its next mayor. And now for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Paris Schutz.
And I'm Brandis Friedman. Thanks for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that's proud to serve its community through pro bono legal services.